current plant is what, 12,000 capacity? That's the capacity of it?
Yeah, there's just let me get back here. Yeah, that's we're doubling the current capacity. So it's about it'll be able to service the urban boundary, which will service approximately 20 to 25,000 people.
And I know you mentioned the cost because of the elevation, because of, I guess it's water from the lake. Flooding, Atterbury and flooding, so you that added what, 50 something million dollars to the original cost?
There was, in the 2019 water supply budget, there was an additional $10 million targeted for this project, and there was approximately four factors in the increased costs. One was elevating the plant, approximately building it higher by 2 meters. There was additional costs related to equipment costs because, and due to the exchange rate. Most of the equipment from our facilities, they're sold in US dollars. So with the exchange rate not being the greatest, there's additional costs there. And there's also additional costs just for the actual equipment that's proposed in the plant that's going to treat the water and control the system.
Okay, so there's no way of keeping that cost down or avoiding?
That is the estimated cost of the project.
Okay, thank you.
Councilor Swart.
Thanks, thanks for coming back again. So what are the opportunities do you see for bringing sewer services to Orno?
To Orno, one of the challenges there, I mean, the there is a technical solution to provide, to bring sanitary sewers to Orno. One of the planning hurdles was that way back, and I don't have the exact dates, but Orno was designated in the regional official plan as a, an urban area. But after the last update of the regional official plan, the province took that designation away. And right now, we're the province is technically not allowing us to extend lake-based services to Orno. So in order to provide sanitary services to Orno, we'd have to plan and build a separate wastewater system for Orno, a communal water wastewater system. And we had historically done some work on that, and it was, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but it was quite expensive.
So I understand that technology is getting better and better all the time. Like, do you see a time in the not too distant future where the region would allow some communal sewer and some development in Orno?
That would be up to council directions to allow that. It would basically, I guess there's a limitation on how large Orno is allowed to grow. So if there was a larger proposed urban expansion or service population, then that would obviously reduce the cost per capita because you could spread the cost over a larger population.
So Orno right now can't grow because we don't have sewer.
That's correct.
And we don't have sewer because we're not growing. So it's kind of a catch-22, right?
It is. It's a very challenging situation. We, as I mentioned, I don't have that report in front of me, but there was a report done on looking at the current conditions of the private services in Orno, and then looking at what would be the cost of a communal system just to service the downtown area. And but I could send you that information if you would like.
So is there new work being done on that?
No, there's no new work done. We don't have any planned projects except for the two water ones.
Thank you.
Councilor Hooper.
Yes, thank you. And I would be remiss if I didn't make mention of, you mentioned something about the structure just across the, out the window there. What actually what purpose does that serve now as we stand here?
Well, right now, water storage facilities, that helps operate the water distribution system, so it provides the necessary pressure regulation in the system, and it has some fire flow and emergency flow storage. So during the day, generally how the water systems work is by gravity. Water is pumped. That's a very small, that was designed when Bowmanville had a very small population. That's not sufficiently large enough for the storage for the way, how much development is currently in Bowmanville. So in order, we have to make that storage facility a lot larger. So right now it is servicing as a floating storage, but it doesn't have enough storage for emergency and fire flows. So that currently that is being served by directly pumping into the system. Like as if there was a fire, that tank would drain quite quickly and then we would pump that fire flow into the system.
So what, through the chair, what will happen to that?
We're planning to take it down.
Guess you haven't been on Facebook lately. No, I'm just kidding. And so
unless there's a, like we had a similar tank in Brooklyn, in Whitby, and there was some talk about keeping it, but then at the end of the day, the municipality decided not to keep it, so we took it down, and it's salvaged. The steel as material is salvaged by a contractor.
Okay, thank you for that. And the zone that you're talking about up Liberty Street to the east, will that service the core areas?
Yes. The new storage reservoir in Bowmanville, yes.
So that will take the place of the existing...
Of the tank, yeah.
Existing water tower.
Yeah.
And how big is that? That will be a tower like that.
That won't be a tower. That will be basically a concrete box underground. It's an in-ground storage facility. So it's a large concrete structure that holds the water. And I'd have to look up the exact volume, but it's going to be enough volume to service the official plan requirements for Bowmanville.
Okay, thank you for that. And one other question. In regards to all the development that's going through with with the infrastructure through Curtis, will there be opportunities for, and I'm not jumping my ship or anything like that, but will there be opportunities for development to plug into that system, or is it strictly for servicing of the northern municipalities?
No, that trunk sewer will service the proposed development urban area, basically in South Curtis, wherever this plan doesn't show the urban boundary, but basically that trunk sewer will service the local sewers, will be built by the development community, which will connect into this large sewer.
And if I can, through the chair, so will there be a lot of, you talked about there'll be burrowing or tunneling, whatever. So will there be a lot of disruption to the neighborhoods in regards to when they put the systems in, or did they just go?
The major disruption is in order to do the tunnel work, they do have to dig shafts. So they're like open cut shafts. So the tunneling machine has to be lowered in that shaft. And then between the two shafts, there's no disruption on the surface. So you won't really notice it, but the major disruption will be at the shafts because the trucks are hauling the dirt out and the trucks are bringing in the pipe. So in that vicinity of the shaft, there's a lot of construction work, but other than that, in between shafts, you won't see anything on the surface.
Okay, one further question if I can. We're, with all this that's going on, we're not going to get any surprises like we did a few years back where we didn't have enough capacity to, and unbeknownst to local council, we had no idea that was the situation.
This is why we have 61 projects and $240 million of investment. We don't want any more surprises.
Great. Thank you very much, sir.
Mayor Foster. Thank you, Mr. Preston. No surprise. Curtis and Highway 2.
Okay.
Is there light at the end of the sewer pipe or water supply pipe that we can get some appropriate servicing?
Okay, that's a local service along Highway 2. And so it's not in our development charges program. The development charges program are projects where we're dealing with large trunk services, major trunk sewers like plants and trunk and feeder mains and reservoirs. In that particular area, I believe on along Highway 2, regional staff and Clarington staff have met, and there are other servicing options for some of those properties.
Which was for all of the private landowners to connect, correct? Am I correct on that?
Yeah, there's some of those properties don't need, to service some of those properties, you don't need the sanitary sewer along Highway 2. You can service it to the south.
You might not know anywhere else in Durham Region along Highway 2 that exists. You know, in a major urban setting, I don't know the answer to that, but
I don't have it right in front of me. But there are areas where the properties are serviced not along the frontage, but along another road.
Fair enough. It's an old bone, and I like chewing on old bones. But you know that.
I'll duly note it.
You know that quite well, Mr. Preston. Thank you.
Yeah, question, Mr. Preston. We've just passed a resolution authorizing a basically front ending of services to one of our industrial courts in South Curtis. So my question is, will the region support Clarington's sort of front ending, and possibly by looking at a bylaw that ensures that any non-participating owners don't get that connection unless they pay us their share of the cost?
I know that I'm not sure if I can commit to a bylaw, but I know that development approval staff and our legal staff are looking at ways to ensure that non-participating property owners will need to pay before they connect. So
none of us are on the Regional Works Committee, but is that something that could be brought forward to the Regional Works Committee and possibly find its way onto a council agenda by way of a report?
If you give us some opportunity to meet
first
with staff, and then we can consult with Clarington staff, then if we can come up with a solution without bringing it up to the floor, then I hope we can do that.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. Okay. And there being no other questions, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Motion on the presentation. Received with thanks. Councillor Hooper, move it. Councillor Zwart, you seconded that? Okay. Comments or questions to that? Councillor Anderson, are you voting or are you?
I'm voting.
Okay. Am I going too slow? Okay. I'll try to speed it up, okay, to accommodate whatever other things you got to do. Okay. I'll call a question. All in favor? That's carried. Okay. Faye Langmaid. Welcome, Faye. And you're presenting on PSD 029, Community Vision, Drury Lands. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good evening, Mr. Chair, Mayor, and members of council, staff, and members of the public. I'm Faye Langmaid, Manager of Special Projects in the Planning Services Department. Thank you for allowing me to provide a brief overview of the events that have brought us to the future community vision for the Drury Lands. The site has a long and varied history within our community. It goes by many names and has local, provincial, national, and international significance, in addition to its architectural significance. There are a number of groups involved in telling the many stories of the site. It began as the Darch Farm. Began as the Darch Farm, but later under the ownership of John Drury, he donated the lands to the provincial government so that they could develop the concept of the boys' training school to address youth delinquency. The story that draws the most interest is that of Camp 30. So this is the outline of the boys' training school when it was first developed as a vocational training school. It used to have the entrance actually from over on the east side at Mearns Avenue that went across the creek and then into the circular system, and many of the buildings are still remaining there. After the boys' school training school ceased in 1979, the site had alternate uses for another 30 years. So since they say a picture is worth a thousand words, I'm going to show you some pictures of what it used to look like. This is when it was first constructed in 1979. So what you see in the foreground is on this side is the Kiwanis house, and on this side is the cafeteria building. In the foreground here is the gymnasium, and this would be sort of something like an opening drive, and then the in the background behind the gymnasium is what was known as Ferguson Hall, which was the main administration building. This is the cafeteria building when it was first built, and then the central green that's in front of it. And one of the things that you don't notice very much now, because the trees have filled in so much, is this elevation difference between where the cafeteria building sits and actually the central green portion of the property. Same thing is true with the triple dorm. It actually sits up on a bit of a promontory, which isn't terribly noticeable because of all the trees that are around it currently. And then the jury lodge, which is set off north of the one tributary and sort of nestled within its own bit of landscape. When it became a prisoner of war, the federal government appropriated the property in 1941. They added additional barracks, which are shown as the red. The red within the campus area were for the prisoner of war officers and high-ranking officials, and the red that's on the east side of Lambs Road were for the Canadian troops who actually guarded the exterior of the fence line, which is outlined in red there. At one time, there were 800 prisoner of war officers held at this site. After the war, it returned to being a prisoner, or it returned to being a boys' training school again. And it operated until 1979, when the Young Offenders Act was changed and the concept of taking youth away from their families was no longer an acceptable idea. When the site closed in 1979, there was heated debate about what should happen with the site. The municipality at the time considered whether to acquire the site. The provincial government did an evaluation of the property, not from a historical perspective, but rather from a land value perspective. They determined that they would sell the property at fair market value. This was the early 1980s, and there was a spike in both land values and interest rates. The municipality was given the opportunity to match the value being offered by the private sector, and on a 4-3 vote, declined to purchase the property. The site then entered a period of another 30 years, and it had a series of different owners and some very good alternate uses, all of them being as educational institutions. After a sewage spill from the private sewage treatment facility into the Soper Creek in October of 2008, the owners, by that time a partnership between Caitlin Group and Fandor Homes, approached the municipality with a request to demolish all of the buildings, and at that time there were 18 buildings on the site. That request began a working relationship between the Clarington Museum, the owners, and the municipality to understand the many stories associated with the site and its future. The council of the day wanted to ensure that the site had significance, but not just for the local community, but also nationally. The national designation was a challenging but ultimately successful process. It took some time for the National Heritage Sites and Museums Boards to assign a Parks Canada researcher to the project. And while awaiting, Ferguson Hall, the main administration building, fell victim to a fire and was ordered demolished by the chief building official for safety and security reasons. The national designation was confirmed in April of 2013, and subsequently, council authorized staff to carry out next steps. There was a call sent out to assist with the formation of an arm length charitable foundation, and Marilyn's already told you about that. The Jury Lands Foundation is instrumental in educating the public about the site and bringing the owners to the table. The municipality had a building conditions survey carried out in 2014. And when the buildings have lost much of their luster, their bones are good and can be refurbished with other uses. We've already heard from Marilyn about those foundation's work, and they've been instrumental in obtaining, as she commented, money to build the trail in 2015. Since that time, they've offered tours of the site and continue to advise staff on next steps. The municipality entered into an agreement with the owners with regard to the future development parcels and demolition of all the buildings except for the six most historically significant ones. Also, the owners committed to the policies outlined in Special Policy F of the official plan. The area that has been slated for residential development, sorry, I'm not keeping up with myself, since 1996 in the official plan, I'm going to move ahead. So that's the area and the 1996 official plan. At the time, it was anticipated that the private school, this is in 1996, that the private school would continue to operate and that the soccer fields at the southern portion of the land would become a community park. The municipality leased the fields from 1998 to 2009. The future urban residential designation of the campus area meant that no planning applications other than zoning changes could be considered until the official plan was reviewed and changed. The review was completed in November of 2016 when Council adopted Amendment 107, a comprehensive review of the official plan, and included next steps as outlined in Special Policy Area F. The Region of Durham approved the official plan in June of 2017. Special Policy Area F called for the development of a community vision and urban design plan for the long-term use of the lands, including the natural and built heritage resources integrated with future land uses. It also called for the designation of the buildings under the Ontario Heritage Act, which occurred in January of 2018. Another schedule to the official plan is the anticipated future trail system for the different urban areas. With the recent decisions that have been made about the former Bowmanville Zoo and residential subdivision to the south of Concession Street and the vision for the overall interconnected trail system, what Marilyn referred to as being the Circle of Green, means that we have a ribbon of trails up through green open spaces. It's anticipated that this municipal park at Camp 30 will become a destination park serving the whole community. And you can see how it's interconnected with where the Visual Arts Center is to the south of Highway 2, then the zoo lands, then the lands that will be designated dedicated as parkland in the Timber Trails neighborhood, and then north of Concession Street where the Jury Lands is. In June of 2018, the community vision was presented at a public meeting at the community at the same time as the concept plan for the Soper Creek Trail and the construction alignment and timeline for that portion from Mearns to Sprucewood was presented. The construction is underway and the paving should occur within the next month. The official plan amendment that would adopt the community vision and overall residential designated designation, including the major street layout, has been circulated to all of the commenting agencies. The owners of the property would like to see higher densities than what is currently allowed in our official plan. We've committed to working with them over the next couple of months, and we plan on having an official plan amendment in front of council at the September 30th Planning and Development Committee meeting. The official plan amendment would include the urban design guidelines, which Megan from DTAH will present after I'm done here. Megan's presentation will also provide some insights into how the various buildings can be reused and the parkland surrounding them redeveloped. Some of the buildings would be mothballed while awaiting refurbishment. The parkland development could proceed once the lands have been turned over to the municipality. We've worked with the owners and the Drury Land Foundation and other stakeholders throughout the process, and we will continue to. Thank you. I will answer questions now, or I can wait until Megan's done her presentation and then answer questions at that point.
My suggestion is when the report's on the table, you can direct questions to Ms. Langley. Is that everybody okay with that?
Okay.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Langley. Okay, so we have Megan Torza. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me. Just going to maximize this if I can. Okay, my name is Megan Torza. I'm an architect and partner at DTAH, and we are the authors of the Urban Design Master Plan and Architectural Control Guidelines for the Drury Lands. Today's presentation will be a somewhat abridged version of a larger presentation I made to the public last year, and further detail is available within the draft report that I believe you have access to. When we were engaged to develop the Urban Design Master Plan for the Drury Lands, we began our investigation with the designation, the literal words of the designation for the site by the National Heritage. Thank you. The whole designation statement on character-defining elements is on this slide. I won't read it to you, but we as master planners distilled it down to a few core elements. The first being that what is important here is that we have a complex of six buildings laid out in a campus style. Campus style means essentially that the buildings are very intentionally relating to each other. They are also very intentionally relating to their surrounding landscape, and that intentionality needs to be preserved. Another aspect of the designation is that those buildings are also organized around an oval-shaped ring road, which is outlined in red in this slide. That ring road historically was a service lane. So it was located actually at the back of the buildings. The front doors to many of the buildings, apart from the triple dorm, actually faced towards the center of the site as opposed to facing the ring road. It is legible even today. The asphalt is still there. And it also crosses through a number of unique topographic conditions, including a tributary along the northern portion of that ring road. So it's a beautiful walk to walk the ring because it gives you views internal to the site as well as views of Soper Creek. And it inherently focuses attention to the center of the ring. Within that ring, there is also still today the remnants of a connection, a series of connected pathways. And those pathways connected the front doors of the buildings together, but also connected those buildings to, again, the center point within the site. And so part of the designation was the recognition that those pathways were an important aspect of the campus. Another aspect within the designation definition was the view planes between buildings. So the buildings are arrayed around this ring road in a very particular way, allowing and affording views beyond the buildings themselves into the surrounding landscape. So having distilled the definition of the designation or the components of the designation, we then began to assess the existing current condition of the site. So outlined in red in this slide are the kind of plateaus of developable land around which we have the Soper Creek system and tributary systems, which are protected by CLOCA. So the territory on which anything new can happen with respect to new buildings or uses is effectively outlined in red on this slide. We have the railway corridor to the north, Concession Street to the south, Lambs Road on the east side, and a stable residential neighborhood to the west. You'll note that that residential neighborhood is characterized predominantly by what we would call backlotted residential units, meaning the front door is on the municipal street and the backyard, which is typically fenced, is facing the Soper Creek Ravine. In future, we were also asked to consider that the crossing of the railway tracks on Lambs Road would ultimately be a grade separated condition, meaning that it was likelihood that you would tunnel beneath the railway in order to allow Lambs Road to pass below it without a conflict. So the Urban Design Master Plan takes that understanding of existing conditions and begins to set forth a framework for new development, acknowledging and respecting the heritage intactness that is desired within the center of the site while wanting to allow for new development, which plays a big role, in fact, in preserving and enlivening the center of the site. The first slide that I show you here is the proposed streets and blocks pattern for the development. So what you see within the red developable areas is a pattern of proposed streets. Starting from the Concession Street, a public road that would connect through that parcel, connecting to Lambs Road, and a secondary road, which we call the Park Drive, that essentially takes the same footprint of the original access drive to the boys' training school and remakes it as a kind of park spine. The central portion of the site would be accessed by that park road, as well as a road from Lambs Road, to the east and west. We propose that that road might continue within the areas to the east, although those areas are subject to a secondary plan. And then roads further to the north, accessing developable areas in the plateau of what we know as phase three and phase four at the top. Those roads are also considered with respect to the type of development that might exist on either side. From a street hierarchy perspective, the intention is to set up a regular pattern of intersections along Lambs Road, some major outlined in red in this slide and some minor, allowing for good access, safe access from an improved Lambs Road to both sides of the street. There would be additional private roads within the development that are not illustrated in this slide, but we assume given a condominium setup or some other kind of tenure that there would be additional roads required. The public space network within this master plan tries to take its strongest cues from the Soper Creek Ravine network itself. So establishing open spaces and stormwater management networks that are integrated and that always flow towards Soper Creek and connect to Soper Creek. At the center of that network is what's proposed as the Drury Lands Park, which you see outlined in colored in a kind of olive green in this slide. And the distribution of parks and open space is intended to be relatively even within the development parcels, and always drawing attention back to the Soper Creek system. Stormwater management plays a similar role, working with the grade that exists today as opposed to against it, and allowing for stormwater to be dealt with on the surface as opposed to within pipes and form a meaningful part of the landscape design. Pedestrian networks also running all the way through the development, allowing for good pedestrian access not only within the residential blocks but also to the park drive and into the Soper Creek system. And parking, which is always a concern, is accommodated in some areas that are already existing parking lots that have a good proximate access to the Soper Creek, as well as in locations against Lambs Road that are useful for the potential reuse of the heritage buildings. So as Faye mentioned, another aspect of our study was to look at how these existing buildings might be reused. And in starting that work, we typically always just look at the buildings themselves, how they were designed, their structure, and how flexible or inflexible they might be to adaptation. So we have six buildings currently. This is a little bit of an older aerial photograph, so some of the buildings that you see here are already demolished, but the six that we that have remained are noted in this slide. So the first building is the old pool or natatorium and gymnasium that you saw in one of the heritage photographs that Faye showed you. The floor plan of this building is on the right-hand side of the screen. It's essentially two large spaces. One holding a pool historically and one with a gymnasium, separated by support spaces, so change rooms and an entry hall and storage. Our feeling is that this building would be, these are some existing photographs of that building, interior and exterior. This building is a highly flexible building in terms of its structure. There's large span open spaces that could be reused in a number of ways. One thing that we thought would be very compatible not only with its position closest to Sober Creek but also with its heritage is to actually reuse the building as a kind of active recreation facility. Gymnasium, multi-purpose space, as you see in the examples on this slide. The triple dorm, which is closer to Lambs Road, is a building that is more cellular in terms of its current layout. This is the existing plan, a lot of small rooms around the perimeter and a large double height area in the center, which is also cellular but not structurally required to be so. This whole gray area could be one space. The thought there was this building would be quite well suited for a kind of office or incubator space where small breakout rooms are useful, but also a large workspace would be a benefit to the user. We see this in Waterloo and in other places where an old building is reused for this type of purpose. The Kiwanis House and the Jury Lodge have a very similar structure, essentially small cellular rooms around a center which is double height and daylit by what we would call clear story windows. Again, similar in scale to some of the other buildings that we've seen already, but in our minds, well suited for a small-scale institutional use like a daycare, where you need smaller rooms around a perimeter for playrooms or classrooms, but then there might be a central space for gross motor play or another kind of more active use. The Jury Lodge, as I mentioned, is a very similar piece of architecture with similar plan and scale. And could be used, again, for a small-scale institutional user or single tenancy where small offices are useful, but also a gathering space at the center could be accommodating of their organization. The infirmary is a two-story structure closer to Lambs Road. It is actually, by design, meant to be more cellular. It is a smaller footprint and has a lot of load-bearing walls, so our thoughts with respect to the future of the infirmary might be something more that you're not tearing down the walls in between the spaces, but in fact using them to your advantage. So a boutique hotel, a bed and breakfast, a restaurant, something where smaller scale rooms is useful. Certainly there's precedent for this. This is in Prince Edward County. And then the cafeteria, which is the largest building on the property, kind of the grandest building on the property by design, we think would be a tremendous asset as some form of venue or gathering space. Certainly in other locations across Ontario where there is a heritage asset, there is an appetite within the marketplace for gathering and events in that kind of setting. And so the cafeteria in our minds would make a very good kind of venue space that could generate some revenue and be supported by some of the adjacent uses like an inn or a restaurant. The landscape in our minds is consistent with this thinking around the adaptive reuse of the buildings, that the landscape promotes and continues the uses within the buildings. So we might have an active landscape in and around the old natatorium and gymnasium that would encourage more active lifestyles, connect to the Soper Creek Ravine system, and create a place for people to go and be more healthful while enjoying the park-like setting of the building. An adjacent lawn could be used for more flexible recreation or gathering, and that would be consistent with the history of the landscape, which is effectively as an open lawn. A children's garden might be established next to the Kiwanis House, for example, if that building were to be reused as a childcare. So a very specific landscape, still naturalized in design, but reflective of the use within the building. a water garden might be established in the low point between the Kiwanis House and the infirmary to demonstrate best practices in stormwater management. On the other side, there might be a food garden, again tied to a restaurant where chefs could grow their own fresh food and vegetables, tying to the agricultural history of the Darch farm. And then an event terrace could be established in and around the cafeteria to allow for outdoor gathering adjacent to that large venue space. And finally, a lookout. The views from the Camp 30 Juryland site across the Soper Creek to the west are spectacular. And so some form of lookout at the top of the trailhead that goes to Soper Creek, we feel would be a nice kind of culminating experience for one's visitor to the site. So lastly, just a few ideas around phasing and implementation. Everyone wants this to happen as soon as possible, as you've heard. And so our feeling is that there are a few things that could be identified as priorities based on our experience with these types of sites. Landscape improvements are relatively cheap in the order of things. And so to improve the trail connection to the Soper Creek system from the site, to establish walking paths with their own interpretive signage in and around the buildings to tell the story of the history of this property, and potentially establish one component of the improved landscape, whether it be the active recreational component or the lawn, something that could be actually utilized by the public in a first phase, could be of great benefit. And then in terms of how you address the buildings. Again, a phased approach is feasible here, where you might restore one of the buildings. Perhaps it's the natatorium, which is closest to the Soper Creek trail system, ensuring that whatever you do with that first building, that it is publicly accessible and that it proves to be useful to the public. So public washrooms, a change room or a gathering space. Those things are generally the first things that one would build in a site like this. The Colonel Samuel Smith Park is an example of this kind of restoration. Establishing just the foothold for the community within the site upon which you can build further and further investment. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you very much.
Questions to the presenter? Okay, seeing none, thank you. Okay, that concludes our presentation. So we have three reports. PSD 027-19, proposed amendments to the Greater Golden Horseshoe 2019 Bill 108. Anybody wish to entertain a motion? Mayor Foster. Moving the as recommended. Okay, seconder. Councillor Anderson, discussion on that motion. Mayor Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there's a lot of stuff in here, but I'm curious on section 4.2, which is page 45, they talk about collecting development charges on the date of application. How much time can pass between an application and actually building?
Mr. Seaman or Mr. Allison wish to?
Years.
So would I be wrong if I'm looking at, for example, High Street Curtis was 1988, or were there things in this? My concern is we collect money, which is diminished in value by inflation significantly by the time the project is done. Am I overstating my concern, or?
No, that's the way the numbers could work out.
All right. So we could see a huge number of applications that would tie things up and no activity for a very long time. And I'm seeing Mr. Salazar nod his head. Okay. On page 47, 6.5, it talks about a prescribed event. Can you tell me what a prescribed event is?
Through you, Mr. Chair, that hasn't been defined yet. The speculation is that it may include a planning application, but that it would be coming through the regulations.
All right, so we've got rules, but we don't know. Never mind. Shouldn't surprise me. All right. On page 49, 7.5, they're talking about EAs. So an exemption from the EA Act and Group A of the GO Transit Class Environmental Assessment. Given what's in front of us right now with the potential expansion, so we've got stations north of the north of the 401, south of the 401, what does that do possibly for the requirements for EAs?
Through you, Mr. Chair. For instance, for the original EA, the provincial government passed legislation to shorten the time frame an EA would take, and they said maximum 6 months, and they sped up the process to complete that EA within that time period. My understanding of this legislation is that it will allow the province to move faster on all transit projects.
All right, so that's faster, including ours.
It hasn't been determined that if ours is included in that.
We're working on that. You're working on that. Thank you. Thank you for that, by the way. And 8.1, if we're looking at brownfields and redevelopment, I'm assuming that that would apply to the Goodyear site. And, you know, amongst a number of changes, that might be a positive change.
Through you, Mr. Chair, that's a possibility, yes.
All right. Page 51, and I don't think you're going to be able to tell me this, item 10.3, so this is the risk conservation fund. So the province is going to manage that fund. Do we have any idea of who would end up collecting? I'm guessing that we're collecting on that and spending, but I don't see a whole lot of detail here, and I'm thinking it simply doesn't exist.
Through you, Mr. Chair, much of the legislation that is being proposed needs to be implemented through regulations. We don't have the regulations yet. So we don't know the details on how this is going to be implemented.
Well, at least it's consistent with the rest of the stuff that we've been dealing with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any other comments or questions? Mr. Pinn wanted to add something to that. Mr. Pinn, welcome.
Through the chair, it's kind of lonely over on this side by yourself when it's not GGC. I did just want to add to the comment earlier about the length of in being years, on top of the fact that the fee is going to be set in at the date of the application, there's 5 years that they're allowed to make payments over. So you're, instead of getting the fee right away on the building permit, in certain circumstances, you're actually receiving the payment over 5 annual payments.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions directed to staff from members of the committee? Seeing none, call the question. All in favor? And that's carried. Okay, and next report is PSD-028-19, renaming of King Street and Hayden, King Street and Bonneville. Mayor Foster, you're moving to recommended action on that. Seconded by Councilor Hooper. Any comments or questions to that? Seeing none, call the question. All in favor? That's carried. PSD-029-19, Community Vision for Drury Lands Urban Design Master Plan. Councilor Traill, you're moving?
Moving the staff record, the recommendations.
Okay, seconder, Mayor Foster. Comments or questions to that? Councilor Traill.
Thank you. I'll keep my comments brief, but I just wanted to commend the consultant. I think they've done a fabulous job. In this day and age, I think far too few historic buildings are preserved. It's always build new. So I think we have a wonderful opportunity here to partner with the private sector to build things that can benefit our community. I know there are many, many residents who are desperate for additional daycare space. I think the children's park is a great idea. I think there's a lot of opportunity here. And I think a lot of thought went into it, and I look forward to seeing many of these proposals become a reality. So thank you to all involved.
Mayor Foster.
Well, thank you. And again, just by way of comment, as you know, FCM was in Quebec City. I found myself reading a plaque in Quebec City, part of the very, very low city that I guess some business people and the government got together. So a wonderful, wonderful historic part. Some of these buildings are 300 plus years old that would quite likely not exist had steps not been taken. So it sounds like it was pretty seedy and run down, and quite frankly, difficult to imagine it as being seedy and run down based on what's there today.
I guess my question is to follow up on the comment by the consultant for Caitlin. Looks like a pretty expensive project. I'm wondering how's that. What's the idea of having how that's going to get paid for? Any to you, Ms. Langmaid.
Through the chair, the parkland development would be the responsibility of the municipality, as it is in all other municipal park cases. The building refurbishment is what the Jury Lands Foundation has as sort of their goals within their bylaws, and the reason that they really would like to get on with having possession of buildings and land so that they could get their charitable status to start raising that money. If you start looking at other projects like the Distillery District in Toronto and the Evergreen Brickworks development in Toronto, both of them had major governmental dollars dedicated towards them because of the historical buildings that were there. The national designation is also key to getting that kind of federal money in the future.
Okay, thank you. All right, I'll call the question. All in favor? It's carried. Any questions to Mr. Our Director of Planning? Sorry, Mayor Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Seaman. We spoke earlier, and Councillor Terrell was all over it. The article in a, if you call it newspaper or what, the Councillor's Ward has an opinion about that. A publication that was sent around suggesting that half of Clarington's land was going to be designated EP. Normally we wouldn't be concerned, but it's written by a former mayor with a former councillor being heavily quoted in it, which gives it a degree of credence. Can you please help us out with that and provide some more insight?
Through you, Mr. Mayor, through the zoning Clarington process, which is ongoing, the zoning bylaw being implemented as after the official plan, which was approved, the consideration of the alignment with provincial policy and the regional official plan is one of the things that we have to do. And through that process, the environmental protection area designation was revised through the official plan. And in the zoning bylaw process, Zone Clarington, the municipality is then required to align the zoning bylaw with that. The new environmental protection was expanded through the province, including things like wetlands, fish habitat, valley lands, significant woodlands, and areas of natural and scientific interests. There's also a 30-meter wide vegetation protection zone. So these sort of alignment with provincial plans and the regional official plan, which is aligned with that, is not an optional thing. It's something that we're required to do. But the process for Zone Clarington is ongoing. And there was an engagement with the Clarington landowners session a couple of weeks ago, and if comments are still welcome, if anyone has any particular concerns about their property, please encourage to make a submission. The town staff, the planning staff, will be reviewing these submissions and bringing forth a further sort of draft bylaw that will take all that into consideration, and that also will be released to the public through the public process on this study. So I'm not sure if that completely answers your question, but this is where we're going with this, and right now there's nothing really there's still fluidity to the process.
So, sort of answered. One, you're still in early stages of consultation. If we determine something, and two, I think the fear is someone's going to wake up in the morning and find out. So farmlands that are under protection or under production, for example, will continue to be under production. Correct?
Through you, Mr. Chair, that is correct. If there is bona fide active farmland, the environmental protection designation would not impact the continued operation of those lands for farming.
Okay, so property owner, if they've got a concern, let you know. It's part of the ongoing consultation.
Yes.
The world has not changed overnight.
Yes, please let our planning staff know. The Zone Clarington team would please to talk to anyone with concerns, and or if there was any submissions received, review those and provide clarity on the whole process.
So, and we probably should talk about maybe getting some communications out that if I read that, and I don't know, we'll chat, but if I read that, you might generate an awful lot of concern that shouldn't exist. So we'll chat, but perhaps chat with staff, our communications officer. It's pretty broadly distributed across municipality. Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Seaman? Oh, sorry. Ms. Lang made one add something to that as well.
Through the chair, actually, the mayor hit it on it that if it's currently in agricultural production and it is designated as EP, you can continue to have it in agricultural production. So,
Councilor Hooper, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Ms. Lang, for explaining that. My comment was just in regards to, it's a comment in regards to. Last week, your planning department hosted a neighborhood character study, PIC, and I just want to say congratulate staff. Very well run PIC, lots of interesting discussion. Actually, there was some laughter in the room, which I found very strange, but I just want to say kudos to staff for very well run. And if the rest of council wants to see planning 101 in regards to character and things like that, and a lot, sizes and things, there's a very good report right there. Well, thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, so Mr. Seaman, the Moto South development there's a three-story building that has all siding on the west side. To me, I don't know, I understand how that could get by our urban design guidelines. So anyway, I'm not sure I'd like to hear back on that. And
Mr. Chair, we'll certainly get back to you and committee with information on that particular development. I don't have that at this time, but we will get back within the week.
Okay. Thank you. And so we have unfinished business. Does that need a motion to lift,
Madam? No, it's a refer.
Refer. Okay. So Mayor Foster, you're moving.
Well, I'm wondering if you want a motion under Section 239(2) of the Municipal Act.
If we want to discuss it.
As amended, so I'll
make making that motion.
I think so.
Okay, so we have a motion for a proposed or pending acquisition or disposition of land by the municipality or local board and matter that deals with advice that is subject to solicitor-client privilege, including communications necessary for that purpose. So you're moving that we close the meeting. Seconder on that is Councillor Anderson. All in favor? And that's, sorry, all in favor? Anybody opposed? Okay, and that's carried. So we'll resume backstage. Thank you. Okay, so we'll rise and report that in accordance with Section 239, subsection 2.1, matter was considered in closed session and one motion was passed to give directions to staff. Councillor Trail, do you have a motion?
I do. This is moved by myself and seconded by Councillor Hooper that the municipality continue to work with the Drury Lands Foundation on the terms set out in the existing MOU to preserve the historical significance of the Camp 30 lands and buildings.
Okay. Comments or questions to that motion? Councillor Hooper.
Recorded vote, too, please.
Comments or questions? Okay, so recorded vote requested by Councilor Trail.
On the resolution moved by Councilor Trail, seconded by Councilor Hooper, as just stated, Councilor Anderson.